Well, let me encourage you to turn your Bibles again with us this morning. 1 Corinthians chapter 16, we've arrived at the last chapter in the book of Corinthians. It's been a lengthy study working our way through this wonderful book, this wonderful epistle. And so we're in the home stretch. We can definitely see the light at the end of the tunnel. Chapter 16 is going to have a number of different practical things that Paul addresses with the church there in Corinth. And so it's going to give us an opportunity to work through those and even find some application for us, even as we're understanding what's going on in this local church assembly. I will say this, just as a reminder, next Sunday morning, May 31st, will be our first time back together in a modified format. And so we want to encourage our members, if you're comfortable doing so, to plan on being here. You'll be getting information from us this week about which service we've asked you to attend, so that we can have some social distancing as well as some cleaning as well. But this morning, we're back in 1 Corinthians 16. And so let me read to you verses 1 through 4, and then we'll get into the text together. Now, concerning the collection for the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, so you also are to do. On the first day of every week, each of you is to put something aside and store it up, as he may prosper, so that there will be no collecting when I come. And when I arrive, I will send those whom you accredit by letter to carry your gift to Jerusalem. If it seems advisable that I should go also, they will accompany me. You know, one of my favorite parts in modern literature happens in Les Miserables. Victor Hugo is writing this, and the criminal, Jean Valjean, shows up at a priest's home, and in the middle of the night, he steals some candlesticks from the priest, and runs off or takes the silverware away from the man's house and runs away. He's captured that evening by the gendarmes, the police. They come, they take him back to the priest's house. He's claimed that the priest gave them to him. And the priest in that moment tells him that he left the best things behind, and he gives them these silver candlesticks. Now, if you were ever to read the book, the author has made a great effort to show that these are the only prized possessions of the priest. The priest led a very simple life. He really lived in poverty and went without. And so he's giving this criminal, Jean Valjean, everything of value that he really owns. And he makes a comment that's summarized in other editions of the book, whether it's in the play or the musical. And he really says this, "I've bought your soul for God." And in that moment, you actually get what the picture of Les Miserables is about. And it's all about redemption. It's the concept that when you've been given much, then you should also then give much. The generosity that Jean Valjean experiences utterly transforms him. It's one of the reasons it's one of my favorite books. But maybe there's another piece of literature that you're more familiar with that helps to picture the concept of generosity from the other direction, from Ebenezer Scrooge. Famously in A Christmas Carol at the opening, he interacts with some gentlemen who are trying to raise funds for the poor during the Christmas and holiday season. And so they ask him what they could put him down to give and how generous would he like to be. Ebenezer, clearly a man of wealth and of means who's been hoarding his wealth. And Ebenezer famously says this, I quote from the book, "Are there no prisons?" asks Scrooge. "Plenty of prisons," said the gentleman, laying down the pen again. "And the union workhouses?" demanded Scrooge. "Are they still in operation?" "They are still," returned the gentleman. "I wish I could say they were not." "The treadmill and the poor law are in full vigor then," said Scrooge. "Both very busy, sir." "Oh, I was afraid from what you said at first that something had occurred to stop them in the useful course," said Scrooge. "I'm very glad to hear it." Now, unless you understand the union workhouses, the horror of that statement doesn't impact you the way it would have Dickens' readers. The workhouses were abysmal places. These were horrendous conditions. It's difficult to even wrap our brains around the level of stinginess and coldness that's exuding from Ebenezer Scrooge in this moment and his refusal to be generous in any way. A British reporter wrote about the workhouse conditions this way. He says there were regular scandals triggered by the standard of hygiene in the workhouses. At Huddersfield, there was a public outcry in 1848 after it was found that 10 children were forced to share a bed. Somebody in the infirmary had been forced to lay in the same bed as a corpse. Just a year later, a school for pauper children in Tooting was the scene of a cholera outbreak which claimed 180 lives. The inquest found that the effects were exacerbated by a lack of food, poor clothing, and overcrowding. It was uncommon for people to be found guilty of cruelty in the workhouses. It was uncommon that any were ever brought to justice. Ella Gillespie was sentenced to 5 years of penal servitude for mistreating workhouse children. She whipped them with stinging nettles, forced them to kneel on the wire netting that covered the hot water pipes, deprived them of water for so long that the children had actually resorted to drinking from the toilets. Charlie Chaplin in his youth spent a few weeks in the Newington workhouse. In his autobiography, Chaplin recounts the Friday morning punishment sessions where the boys lined up on three sides of a square. The miscreants were then caned in front of their peers, often fainting and even requiring treatment in the infirmary. And Scrooge's response when asked to simply give to the poor was to say, "Are there no workhouses for these people?" His lack of generosity, his stinginess, his selfishness, his closing up of his heart is actually a perfect picture of lostness. It's a condition where we are far from God, where we are sinners, and all of us are born this way. And having not experienced the generous kindness of God in faith believing, our hearts are shut up and cold to the needy. Paul is going to be interacting with the Corinthians about generosity in their giving. And before we can understand generous giving, we actually have to be moved by generosity. Now, of course, the greatest generosity has been by God towards us. But who among us can look upon the needy, the poor, the destitute, and close up our hearts to them? You know, if I'm going to be fair, I think in the realm of Christianity, I think we can all be honest about this, giving is a hard thing to talk about. It's a hard thing to preach about. But if we're really honest, a failure to give, I think in a Christian sense, it absolutely can be spiritual. And we're going to spend some time talking about that. But it can also just be even simply practical. The need is not in front of our eyes, and so we easily forget about it. And the real revelation happens when the need is brought to our attention, like it was to Scrooge, and we still refuse, we still resist. We have to ask then, what is going on in the heart of a believer if they would not be faithfully generous in their giving? And so Paul's beginning this process of addressing this concept with the Corinthians. Our takeaway this morning would be to understand this. Faithful, generous giving is actually both a practical and a spiritual matter. When you reflect upon the generosity of God toward you, it should move you. You know, it's interesting. I think of moments in my life where people have been generous to me. One that stood out, I remember when I was a young man and I was in a singles group with a church. We went on a trip and I made a very foolish decision and I shattered the window of the church van. And the pastor and the deacons generously forgave me of that and didn't want me to have to pay for the window. They were just being generous to me and kind to me. I remember feeling so incredibly loved in that moment. I've had other folks pay for meals and provide food and goods and meet needs. Generosity moves you. It changes you. My guess is you can even think right now in this moment of times that people have been generous to you. But no one has been as generous to us as God in the giving of his own son to us. And he then calls us to respond to his generosity with faithful generosity on our own. So faithful, generous giving is both a practical and a spiritual matter. Now, I want to explain to you exactly what's happening here because it is an interesting, feels like you're jumping right into the middle of a conversation. In many ways, we are. If you look back down at your text, Paul says this, now concerning. Now, what's interesting is he's used that same phrase a couple of different times in the book of Corinthians to make a transition. And what Paul is doing, you might remember, we've been a long time in Corinthians, is he's answering a series of questions on one hand. The Corinthians had written him a letter asking a series of questions. However, those that brought him the letter had also brought their own reports about what's going on in the church in Corinth and their own issues. So when Paul responds to their questions and the other information he's gotten, we get 1 Corinthians. And 1 Corinthians shifts back and forth between the two, Paul dealing with his concerns and answering their questions. When he uses this phrase, now concerning, it's really become kind of code language in the book of 1 Corinthians to tell us, I'm moving away from something I wanted to talk about to answering one of your questions. So he just finished dealing with their confusion over the resurrection. He's now coming back to a conversation with them. So they would have understood exactly what he's talking about here when he says that now concerning, and they're collecting something. They're collecting money for the church in Jerusalem. When he does this, then, we need to understand that the need is very real, and the Jerusalem church is a church in desperate straits at this point. The church in Jerusalem began by being flooded with folks that had traveled to Jerusalem. You might remember folks had come to Jerusalem. They'd been there for the Passover. The city would swell. We know that people came from all over the Mediterranean to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover. They'd been there for the Passover, and then many of them had stayed till Pentecost. Well, what had happened at that Passover was Jesus had been crucified and raised from the dead. And so this was a huge deal. And so folks were coming to be saved, and they wanted to stick around and hear what's going on. They had heard now of the preaching and teaching of this Messiah, this rabbi. So they waited the 40 days plus till Pentecost. Well, we know at Pentecost, Peter preaches, and 3,000 are saved and added to the church. We know from other letters in the New Testament that folks had traveled even as far away as from Rome. The church in Rome had been founded by people that had traveled there. Most likely, the church in Crete had been founded as a result of people having gone, been there at Passover and Pentecost. So some went back, but many did not. And so it would be like if you and I went away on a long trip. We said, I'm going to plan to travel to, the Grand Canyon. I'm going to plan to be there for a month. And I go there, and you have your resources, you take care of the things at your home, you travel all the way to the Grand Canyon, you spend a month, but then things happen that are just so amazing, you don't want to leave there. So you stay 2 months, and then 6 months, and then a year. And you're trying to establish yourself there in the midst of a situation where jobs are slim, the land is already bought up, maybe you're a farmer, you were a herder back home, you were a merchant. How do you establish yourself? And those folks were staying because they're now part of the church. And so the church from its beginning began, listen to this, with refugees. The church's inception starts with thousands of people that have traveled from all over the Mediterranean to be there and to be a part of it. And so they're trying to work this out. And so the church in Jerusalem immediately is in financial need because they want to care for these people that are among them. We know on top of that, that the church in Jerusalem had a significant number of widows. How significant was it? Well, it was such a big deal that the apostles, who are the elders of the church there in Jerusalem, are trying to meet people's needs and make sure people are fed. And there's so many that a large number of the Grecian widows, their needs aren't being met. This wasn't a racial issue, but it looked like one. It probably had more to do with who they had relationships with. In other words, the needs they were aware of are getting met. The needs they're not as aware of are not getting met. And so what's the answer? That's where we get the office of a deacon. So we think of them as proto-deacons or first deacons. They elect these seven men who then serve, and now they're serving the widows. So we know we've got refugees that have traveled, people that are transplants to their region now as a result of the church. Now, then we know on top of that, we have all these widows that are there. We know that there's some folks that have some means, because they're even taking their property and selling it and giving the money. On top of all of that, within a year or two of the Church of Jerusalem being founded, a massive famine came into the region of Judea. Well, it's an agrarian culture. The vast majority of people are farmers. The money that fuels the region, the economy, is fueled by farming, agriculture. Well, when a famine comes through, suddenly farmers can't trade their crops for the other things that they need. You can't do sustenance-based living when there's a famine. And so there are people in tremendous need. On top of that, there was economic persecution. Massive persecution is taking place. We see that with the stoning, really the murder of Stephen. And so people are not wanting to give them jobs, not wanting to sell them goods. And so when you combine all that together, we have this church in Jerusalem of several thousands of people that are in desperate need. And so this need has been communicated to Paul, and Paul has communicated to these other churches. And so we know we have this church in desperation. And if we actually look at it, this becomes a pretty dominant issue throughout the New Testament. You can actually track this through a number of different books. And for sake of time, we're not going to look at all these. But you see its conclusion ultimately in Acts 24 when Paul shows up with the gift. He references it to this letter to the church in Rome in Romans 15. He writes about it here in 1 Corinthians. He returns to the issues for two chapters in 2 Corinthians, and he references it in a significant way in Galatians. Paul gives his own testimony of how this love offering that he's trying to raise for the church in Jerusalem, how this even began. You can see it in Galatians 2, 9 and 10. When James and Cephas, that's Peter, and John, who seemed to be pillars, in other words, these are the head of the church in Jerusalem. We know from the Jerusalem council that took place in the book of Acts, James is kind of the lead elder there in the church of Jerusalem, the brother of Christ, who seemed to be pillars, perceived the grace that was given to me. They gave the right hand of fellowship to Barnabas and me that we should go to the Gentiles and they to the circumcised. Only they asked us to remember the poor, the very thing I was eager to do. This, we would call it in modern days, love offering, began with the pastors in Jerusalem asking them to help. They recognized that their means were running short. One can only imagine. Peter had been a fisherman, but now he's supposed to be a fisher of men. These guys knew how to get food. John, likewise. But they were running out of the resources. It's hard to imagine being in your church and recognizing there are people sitting there that haven't eaten that week. There is tremendous need. And their response to that need was to ask Paul to get the Gentile churches to help. I think that's shocking in one level because we live in a westernized culture that the very act of asking for help is often viewed as wrong. But here in this example, we have three godly men who are humbling themselves and asking Paul. Paul's going to these other churches because by and large, the Gentile churches had much better means, much greater wealth. Not all of them, not in every situation. And in fact, as persecution would rise, their economic wealth would diminish. But here at the start, they're looking to raise this offering, and Paul begins traveling around. He makes a missionary journey that's almost exclusively devoted to this issue. So he goes and he encourages churches, lets them know, they raise the offering, he's going to take the offering back to Jerusalem. We ultimately know, if you were to look through those texts, the churches that specifically are named that get involved in this offering are the church in Corinth, the church in Rome, the churches in Philippi, Berea, and Thessalonica all give to this tremendous need, and the monies are then taken back to the church in Jerusalem to help them. I want us to understand then, when Paul is talking in 1 Corinthians 16, he is talking about, and you've heard me already use this term, what we would reference as a love offering. What we mean by that is this is giving that is in addition to and on top of their regular giving. This is beyond the things that they would give normally to support the poor among them in their church body, the widows that were in their church body, and the elders that were in their church body. James has makes it very clear, ultimately what happens to the church of Jerusalem is because of persecution, there's a great dispersion, or diaspora we call it. And as they are, it's almost like God brings his fist down upon the church and it scatters them because he told them he wants them to take the word out to the uttermost parts of the world. And he uses persecution to do that. So James writes this pastoral letter to the Jews as they're scattered abroad. And he pleads with them to take care of the poor that are among them. He pleads with them and tells them that true faith is to take care of the widows and the orphans, the needy that are among them. And as a matter of fact, he says to look at a person who would come into your church who is naked or hungry and say, be warm and filled, really showcases you must not know God. I just want to remind us again that we are generous because we've received generosity. And when we are stingy, we are acting as though we've never received the generous hand of God that he gives to us. This offering then is in addition to that. Paul commands the church to take care of their elders, to pay them. A workman is worthy of his hire. He proves his point in Corinthians that with 1 Corinthians. He actually has to argue it again in 2 Corinthians. He argues for it in Romans, why they should even give to this, because they've received spiritual blessing. They should give back material blessing. So this is an offering. This is a sacrificial offering on top of their regular giving. And it's important that we understand it in the context here. Having said that, the truths that he gives to us about giving really apply whether it's a love offering, this special opportunity to give to a specific need, or if it's our regular consistent giving, because the truths really are the same. And we can look at it two ways, and that's what we'll do this morning. We'll look at it practically, and then we'll look at it spiritually. So back down in the text, first thing I want to direct your attention to then is that it's planned giving. It's planned. Now concerning the collection for the saints as I directed the churches of Galatia, so you also are to do. On the first day of every week, each of you is to put something aside and store it up, as he may prosper, so that there will be no collecting when I come. And then he tells them the practical ways of how the money's going to get to Jerusalem. When I arrive, I'll send those whom you accredit by letter to carry your gift to Jerusalem. If it seems advisable that I should go also, they will accompany me. Now, Paul is answering their questions, so our natural tendency would be to say, well, what are the real questions the Corinthian church is asking? Well, we can't know for sure, but the answers he provides do point us to probably what they're asking, and all of his answers really surround the practicality of this. He first notes that they're not the only church he's asking for. He says it's the churches all in Galatia even. And I just read to you from Galatians how he described it, the event there in his letter to them. We know from other places he goes to Rome and Philippi, Berea, Thessalonica, all these places to raise these funds. It's not just Corinth alone. So it may have been that they asked, where are we the only ones? It may have been that they asked, when should we collect this offering? It may have been that they asked, how's the money going to get there? You'll notice that he says, I'm willing when I come to send a letter of recommendation. Persecution was becoming so severe in the church in Jerusalem, they were having to become careful, guarded against just strangers showing up and having to ask questions and understand. So a letter of introduction would have been very common to say, hey, we're from Corinth. Here's these monies. Here's a letter from Paul to verify who we are. Paul even notes, maybe the Corinthians asked, well, because we know they're not really trusting Paul, So maybe they didn't want to just hand the money to him, right? So can we send our own people? Well, maybe that was one of the questions. Can we send our own people, Paul, to go to Jerusalem? Or are you going to go to Jerusalem? So we can think that you can kind of perceive maybe by the answers Paul's giving, but what they all boil down to, those practical considerations. So the first thing he says in the answer is, I want you to plan to give. Plan on giving every time you come together. This is actually one of the texts we would point to help us to understand the early church met on Sundays, the first day of the week. And so what's very clear is it was going to be every single Sunday they were going to collect an offering specifically even for this need that was in front of them. The commitment to Christian giving is not and should not be dissimilar to the way we pay all of our bills. Now that's a hard pill for some folks to swallow. The language Paul actually uses here to plan on it and it being collecting is the same language they would use for collecting taxes. Paul is telling the Corinthians, you should be giving in a consistent, faithful, generous way. Weekly. On a routine basis, even. This should be something that is just part of the norm of what you do. Now, so one way to look at giving for the Christian would be that as I receive, I'm going to give. And so whether that's a weekly paycheck, a monthly paycheck, what have you, or maybe you have the kind of job or business, an entrepreneurial kind of position where your income comes in spurts and runs, and it's not on such a consistent basis as we think a normal 40-hour work week even. But as I receive, I'm going to give. That's one way to think about Christian giving. Unfortunately, I don't think that's the way most Christians think about giving. I think the cultural influence that we live in, that we think, and people already think about this way, the church in general, that they shop for church. Church is something that I pick based on what it can do for me. Does it have this program, or can it meet this need over here, or does it do that for me? In other words, it's more like going to a restaurant than it is a Christian responsibility and a fellowship and a family. And unfortunately then, sometimes people begin to think about giving the same way they would think about going to a restaurant. And let me put it this way. Our family, as most of you know, loves San Jose. I don't mail San Jose a weekly check. I pay San Jose when I go to San Jose. But if I'm not at San Jose, I don't send them my money. And unfortunately, when we live in a culture that thinks about church much more like shopping, it's easy for them when they're there to give. But if they happen to not be there a week or 2 weeks, they don't worry about giving. It didn't serve me those weeks. And Paul, by using this language of this planned, consistent giving, he is telling us, as Christians, we should think about our giving in one sense as a responsibility before God and to others. It's a way of imaging generosity. And so he tells them to plan on giving on a weekly basis. Now, this planning, then, we can break it down to four reasons. Why would you do this? Why is it like this? Why couldn't they just take one offering? Why does Paul want them to do this consistently over a long period of time? And again, while this is a love offering, all these can apply to us. First of all, you can give more to this need over time. And that's just, I think, basic economics that we can all understand. Paul's reality is our reality. Our lives and our bills and our needs and our responsibilities, they can seem to shift from month to month. And so each month could seem to look different, but if they give a portion every week, if they give some every week, they will be able to give much more over a long period of time to this need. We should plan on giving consistently and faithfully over time. That's how we should think about giving, not a once a year, not a twice a year kind of thing. Here's a need. Let me just get to that. So whether it's a love offering, if you can extend it, you should. Those of you that attend our church, you know that as we've had the opportunity, we've done that. We've said, you know, we're going to give you the chance. Here's a window of time for you to give to this. And what we like to do is a month or more even, because we want to give multiple weeks, because we understand you might have one bill one week that really knocks down what you'd be able to give to a need, but then another week you don't have that same bill. We want to match this. Why do we come up with this idea? Because that's just who we are? No, because it's actually straight from Scripture. Paul wants them to be setting aside every single week. This actually tells us something even that I think we all know about money. If we don't plan to give it this way, the vast majority of us find somewhere to spend it. We're maybe even shocked what we spend it on. And then suddenly it's not there. And so Paul is telling them, you can give more to this need over time by giving in this planned, consistent way. You can give prayerfully. This gives you time to pray about it, to think about it, to consider, what should I give? Paul is encouraging this overarching mindset for them to have, this mindset of this. The need exists, excuse me, and I want to step into that need. So let me set aside these monies just for that purpose. How much then should I set aside? And that's a great spot for prayerful consideration and reflection. I think a great way to think about even giving sacrificially and giving prayerfully is consider something, maybe at times if there's a love offering moment, and again, I think this is separate from your regular consistent giving. I think it should be regular consistent giving. And what really is damaging if a need is presented and you have like maybe a love offering opportunity and you simply say, oh, I'm going to take my regular consistent giving and this month I'm going to give it to that. Well, that doesn't help anything, actually. But instead, you should give your regular consistent giving and think of this as an additional sacrifice. Well, a great way to approach that would be to consider, what can I give up this month so that I can give sacrificially to that? And I think all of our budgets are different. So, you know, the easy one that all the organizations pick on is give up your coffee for that week, right? Give up your $2 to $4 cup of coffee and give it to this. I'll leave it to you, because if you know Christ, again, you've received generosity, you're going to want to be generous. And so you have your consistent giving. That's very different from this. And so Paul is wanting them to consider prayerfully, what can I give to this on a consistent basis? You can give more than once, and this is good for our souls. The pattern of giving here is going to keep on going until this need is met or until Paul arrives. Maybe they'd even asked how much is needed. Here at our church, if there's a love offering, we'll say, this is the need. Can we give to this? And what can we give to this? Maybe they'd even ask Paul how much is needed. And this would have been one of those situations, as I've already informed you what the church in Jerusalem was like. I mean, that's an open-ended kind of deal because they needed a lot. They don't have cell phones, so they're not going to know exactly when the need is met or when Paul is coming. We actually find out that it's more than a year from this time till the offering is actually collected. Sometimes we will give and we keep on giving, and God will use those monies in the future at a time that we haven't yet been able to determine. One last one about the planned giving is you can give it efficiently. Paul is burdened that the giving has occurred before he shows up. He didn't want them trying to scramble when he arrived to take the monies to Jerusalem to try to raise the monies. The need is real, the opportunity is present, but the payment is yet to come. And he wants there to be no delay in serving those struggling saints in Jerusalem. I don't have time to unpack all the practicalities here, but I would also point out that Paul intends a group of people to take these monies. There is proper safeguards to this. There is not embezzlement that's going to take place. Theft, internal theft, is not going to take place. There are other practicalities here to ensure. If you had a letter of recommendation, Paul could have known the amount ahead of time. So let's just say it's $1,000. He could have written to Peter, James, and John and said, hey, we send this $1,000 from Corinth in the hands of these men. Well, it merely makes it hard for them to show up with something less than the amount that's sent. So there's all these other practical ways that they're careful with it. And so there's a planned giving, but then there's also prosperous giving. Notice that Paul says, set aside, put something aside and store it up as he may prosper. The second practical consideration that we should live in then is some folks in your church will be able to give more than others because they have more means than others. I hope that's obvious, but Paul felt the need to point it out. Greater wealth should mean greater ability to give to the work of ministry. The practical reality of this is that we should examine what we have so that we can give. As you go through the seasons of life, I think we all even live in the realm of economics, that you typically start making very little, and that increases and increases, and then you maximize what you're making, and then it decreases over time. Your giving should match that arc even. Now, it may be that God blesses you in such a way that it doesn't downslope, but for most people, it will. And so he's telling them to consider what you have, and so you should give accordingly. There's a lot of argument over the years, and people ask, well, how much should that be? And so the common lingo that you'll hear in a lot of churches is a tithe. And by tithe, they mean 10%. And then on the other hand, you say we're under the New Testament model, which is grace giving. In other words, as each one is profited, the New Testament never gives us a percentage or amount. And they say, well, that's just under the law, so it doesn't matter. And to be fair with you, you can make arguments both ways. I don't believe the tithe is for today. However, I don't think saying 10% is the law either, because the first one that gave 10% was Abraham, and that was before the law ever showed up. In other words, there should be an amount on a consistent basis you give out of your increase. And so Paul's recognizing that on top of their consistent giving, there's going to be other increase that they have. How can I give it out of that to meet this need? Let me give you two phrases that I'm going to borrow from a pastor, Vance Pittman, that he says Christians should think about giving. It should always be a portion. This is just practical here. It should always be a portion, and it should be sometimes sacrificial. You know, our church at times has had love offerings. We've helped the Rulies when their computers and other things were stolen in Morocco. We've helped the farmers in Indonesia with some health needs. Denise Nelson to minister to her parents flying from France back to the States. A vacation for Miriam Wheeler when we supported her as our missionary to the Ukraine. This church has given love offerings. I've received love offerings from this church. And these are on top of consistent, regular giving. We should always then think those as sacrificial, but there should always be a portion. Can I just ask you, do you consistently give a portion? I don't know what anyone in this church gives. None of the elders do. But Paul is challenging our hearts here about the practicalities of giving. Do you always give a portion, and do you sometimes give sacrificially? Those would be the truths. And so that's the practical perspective, but then there's a spiritual perspective about giving. Now, I need to tell you something. 1 Corinthians 16 is only the first part of this story. And we're not going to have time to get into all the second part, because the second part will happen when we work our way through 2 Corinthians, and it's from chapters 8 through 9. The fact of the matter is, if you've been around church long enough, you've heard phrases about giving. God loves a cheerful giver. Let me give of myself first and then my offerings also. Those are all 2 Corinthians 8 through 9 kind of phrases. Why does that happen? Because something takes place between 1 Corinthians 16 and 2 Corinthians 8 through 9. And it's this. The Corinthians stop giving faithfully and consistently. It drops off. They grow weary of this offering. They get lazy in their giving. Now, there's something very interesting about this laziness. Paul sends Titus to them. And Paul remarks about how well they refreshed and cared for Titus. Certainly, it's spiritual because they are repentant in front of him. but it's also practical care for them. In other words, the Corinthians were really good at this. When the need was right in their face and with them, it affected them personally, they found it easy to give to. Their laziness in their generosity and giving, their lack of faithfulness could be tied directly to forgetfulness. They forgot their responsibility and their opportunity. And so Paul is reminding them, he'll take two chapters to call them then to the spiritual issues. And so the Corinthians are writing about practical questions in 1 Corinthians, and he's answering them. But this same need becomes a launching pad in 2 Corinthians to deal with the spiritual issues. They have started well, but he's worried they're not going to finish well. And he's actually concerned it's going to be humiliating to them. Apparently, the Corinthians, when they found out about this need, they had said, we want to give to this, and we can't wait to give to this. Maybe that was even tied to the questions they had sent him. And so as Paul's traveling around, and he's challenging the other churches to give, he's telling them, well, listen what the Corinthians are planning. Listen how the Corinthians are giving every week. And then he finds out they've fallen away from that. He says it to them this way in 2 Corinthians 8:11. So now finish doing it as well. As well as what? As well as they started. So that your readiness in desiring may be matched by your completing it out of what you have. And then later on in the same section as he's preaching them about this in 2 Corinthians 9:3-4, but I am sending the brothers so that our boasting about you may not prove empty in this matter, so that you may be ready as I said you would be. Otherwise, if some Macedonians come with me and find that you're not ready, we would be humiliated, to say nothing of you, for being so confident. He goes on then in 2 Corinthians 8-9, and he lists five spiritual ways they should think about giving. And so the questions are practical here, and 2 Corinthians, they're all from the spiritual perspective. And so I'm not going to deep dive into all those, but I am going to give you those five just kind of as we fly past them. First of all, he tells them that they should give out of a heart of fellowship. And we can actually see that same sense right here in 1 Corinthians 16. Concerning the collection for the saints, I directed the churches of Galatia, so all you also. There's several times in the book of Corinthians he's reminded them, this is the same command I give to all the churches. This is for everyone. There was a tendency in Corinth to be isolationist, to think only of themselves. And so he appeals even in 1 Corinthians 16 to that sense, and he does it strongly in 2 Corinthians 8-9. He says they're part of a bigger ministry perspective. He says in 2 Corinthians 8-9, he puts the offering in stunning terms. He said it's for the sake of the koinonia, the fellowship, the community. God intends to use giving to the needs of others as a means of uniting them. Now that's very different than an interest-based loan. An interest-based loan says, you now owe me for what I've given you. An interest-free loan, at minimum, says, I'm not going to make a profit off of you. I want to help you in this season of need. A gift like this unites them. It binds your heart to them. You've freely given them because you want to bless them and out of love and of affection. Sometimes we don't give in faithful generosity because we are isolated spiritually from others and their needs. They gave to James when he showed up. But they don't want to give to this. Excuse me, to Titus, but they don't want to give to this need. They've forgotten about it. And so it's for fellowship's sake. We should give faithfully and generously. It's for service sake. Why was the church in Jerusalem so quick to give to one another? Remember, they're selling their property and giving it. Each one gave as he had ability. They're welcoming one another in each other's homes. So maybe they didn't have money always to give, but they said, but I can feed you. Come to my house this week for a meal. It doesn't cost me much to make a little bit extra. I've got to feed my family. He that doesn't take care of his family is worse than a heathen and an infidel. So I've got responsibilities God wants me to meet. But it doesn't take much more money to add to my meal. And I can feed you that way, right with my own family, as opposed to trying to give you enough money. Maybe I don't have the means to do that. Why was the church in Jerusalem like this? Why did they function so well this way? Because they loved one another. Remember, they didn't know each other that well. You've got people from all over the Mediterranean. So this is not necessarily people that have all grown up together. They are bound together by their love and affection of Jesus. They're motivated because of the generosity that they've received from God. It's specifically called a service in 2 Corinthians, and it puts it this way, and it's the same word we actually use for deacon, diakonos. So I thought it necessary to urge the brothers to go on ahead of you and arrange in advance for the gift you have promised, so that it may be ready as a willing gift, not as an exaction. This word gifting is service. He views this as a Christian responsibility. It's an opportunity for ministry. So how should we then think about giving as both a responsibility and a freedom? Because Paul makes it clear, this isn't a bill. I'm not billing you. So here's right. In one sense, we should think about giving as an ongoing, uses words like taxation even, as this is my consistent giving. But he understands if that's all of our motivation, so that's what it should look like. But that's not the heart that drives it. The heart that drives it must be one of free love and affection. I've received from God, so I'm giving to you. And so how do we maintain that kind of balance? Well, I think we can do it this way. First, by thinking of it as a ministry service to others. Because I'm called to love others. I want to give to this because I want to love you. I want to encourage you. I want to advance the ministry of God and the kingdom of God. And the other way is by immediately thinking of it as another word he uses, the grace of it. It shows up in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 4, 6, 7, and 19. He says you're to be motivated to give because you have received grace. You want to show grace. Their tangible giving reflected the undeserved grace they had received from God. We are generous because God's been generous to us. We cannot claim to know God and be stingy people. So we should think of it as a grace that we've received that we want to show. We should think of it as a blessing. This is the appeal of Paul specifically in Romans on this issue. You're going to bless others, and we see it again show up in 2 Corinthians 9, 11 through 13. You will be enriched in every way, to be generous in every way, which through us will produce thanksgiving to God. For the ministry of this service is not only supplying the needs of the saints, but is also overflowing to many thanksgivings to God. By their approval of this service, they will glorify God because of your submission that comes from your confession of the gospel of Christ and the generosity of your contribution for them and for all others. Now, how do I illustrate this? Okay. So when I was working construction, and many of you know me, I'm a car guy. I got the car bug from my dad and from his family. I love cars. But I'd never been around dragsters and drag racing. And I worked construction, and my boss was very involved in drag racing. He had a couple of really cool cars, and he wanted me to like drag racing. And so he gave me free tickets to go away to Maple Grove and watch dragsters, top fuel dragsters, go down the track, quarter mile. John Force was there, got a signed picture from him, and went around the pits. And I remember sitting there as a car guy, and I looked to the right of me, I looked to the left of me, and there's all these people sitting there wearing gas masks and huge earmuffs, and all I had was these little earplugs. They actually give you earplugs on the way in. And I remember thinking, oh, okay. So I pull up my earplugs, put them in, and then the nitromethane engines start roaring. And the fumes are so powerful. That's why these people had gas masks on, because of the nitromethane fumes. The power of these engines was so substantial. When they would fire up and do a burnout, the sympathetic vibration, your whole body would shake. And when they would go down the track 300 plus miles an hour, I was hooked. And I remember coming to work on Monday morning, and my boss was standing there. He smoked unfiltered Marlboros, right? So he's standing there with a Marlboro in one hand, a cup of coffee in the other hand, outside 6 o'clock in the morning when I pull up. He's just waiting for me. And I get out and he goes, how was? And I said, this was awesome. And he loved it. He wanted me hooked on drag racing. He was excited, and he paid hundreds of dollars for me to delight in something he delighted in. This is what Paul's saying. Your generous giving is fueling the delight in God of others. You are so zealous that people would love and glorify God that you give freely of your material means to meet their needs. Because suddenly they say, what a bounteous God we have that he would send me such riches to meet my needs. I was praying that he would meet my needs. And then this check arrived. I was seeking God. How would I pay for this? and then he paid for it through you. Paul says this, it's a blessing to give because it fuels the worship of others. And then there's one last one spiritually, and that it's, we should think of it as a divine service. Our perspective of it, it should be as a divine service. What is different there? It's this, it's about serving God. In other words, I'm going to give in this moment, not necessarily because of the need. I'm going to give not necessarily because of the critical nature of it. I'm going to give because I want to be like God. God gives, so I'm going to give. It's going to give me an opportunity to do something. I was talking to Darren the other day, rejoicing in my 14-year-old getting older. For years, I've taught my sons and had them work on cars with me and do things with me. And I know this reality. You can do things, I can do things faster, quicker, easier, but they're not going to learn if I don't let them do it. And I haven't always been great at that. Lots of times it's just been, hand me the tools till you learn the names of the tools and these kinds of things. But we had to put a hitch on the back of my van the other week. And my 14-year-old willingly came out, yeah, Dad, let me give you a hand. He quickly found the socket wrenches and the other wrenches, and I watched and I delighted as he did it. And it was like I had this weird moment. If it was a movie, it would have been a flashback moment. Because I remember sitting on the driveway at 5922 Baltimore Street with a Ford Econoline van sitting in front of me up on jack stands, and I've got my legs wrapped around this wheel hub assembly as my dad is handing me tools and I'm changing brakes for the first time as a teenager. And it was like this surreal moment, dad to son. And I just smiled because it was a unique joy in me learning to do it like I saw my dad do it, but then in teaching my son to do it the way my dad taught me to do it. When I think about giving, I should think this way, believer. I put this money in and I'm thinking about how when God fed thousands by the Sea of Galilee, and how he provided more quail than they could eat, and how Boaz left the fields, and Ruth was moved by generosity. Putting my hands on the tool to put it in action, putting my hands on the money to put it in play, and I don't care if you do it on your phone, moving from this account to this account is a moment where I get an understanding of God that I can't get any other way. Paul says we should give because it gives us a unique opportunity to be like God, to become more like Jesus, because it's a divine service. You know, the Corinthians have started well, but they have not finished well. They have lost both the practical and the spiritual perspective. They need to have both of those and then drive that through the reality of the need. Maybe it wore off, the novelty of it. Maybe they imagined every week as they were setting aside the money in a little jar to bring it to church that Sunday, they were imagining all the other things they could do with those monies. Maybe they simply put the need out of their mind altogether. Maybe they became westernized mindset judgmental. Well, you know what? Those people in Jerusalem probably don't have as much because they don't work as hard. When Scrooge is transformed, he doesn't just have a moment of generosity. He's thoroughly rescued from his stinginess. He experiences generosity because he can now clearly see the connections from his own past to his own future. The result of the accounting of his life changed him. Dickens expresses it in words we can all understand. He does it with money. But Dickens isn't the first one. Jesus, in communicating the concept of stingy hearts or unforgiving hearts, tells the amazing parable of the man who owns what would be equivalent of something like $11 billion in our dollars, and he's forgiven his debt. And he goes immediately out and grabs a man who owes him a few thousand dollars and grabs him by his throat and threatens him, I'm going to throw you in debtor's prison. And it's stunning to Jesus' audience. And he's using money to illustrate something because money is something we can all understand. Because the decisions I make with my money flow out of my heart. And Jesus is saying, when we've received forgiveness from God, we recognize all the generosity and all the forgiveness we've received from God, which is so far beyond what we could ever have hoped or thought of or imagined. how on earth could we receive that and not be willing to forgive the sins that other people do against us? And he puts it in monetary terms because we can all understand the monetary ideas. At the very core of faithful, generous giving is the truth of the gospel. God has fed us like starving people in the wilderness. He's been generous to us, so we are compelled then to be faithfully generous to others. You know, it's interesting because the Bible, and it's a verse I learned as a child growing up, that God owns a cattle on a thousand hills. That means that his wealth is beyond compare. Jesus promises to not have his children go without food or without clothing. But don't you find it interesting that you have three apostles, Peter, James, and John, and then a fourth in Paul, that their response to the poverty impoverished in Jerusalem, their response to the needs of the local church, was not simply, well, God will provide. They understood this. Those cattle in a thousand hills, that included their own bank accounts. And God intended to feed and clothe and care for his people through their means. And so they didn't see this as a lack of faith. They understood that this is how God built the faith community. That it would be a community of people that have received generously from God, and so they will be faithfully generous back with their goods and their means. Can I just give you an encouragement then? Three just little practical tips. Can I just encourage you to do like Paul, as Paul's commanding, give a portion. Give a portion. You should plan to do it. You need to be consistent in doing it. It needs to be proportionate. You get a raise, Paul says, as you're blessed, if your income goes down, you may be able to get, you may have to give less. That's okay. What you should do is give faithfully. That's what's important, faithfully. Not like a restaurant. Think of it as a responsibility before God, but not driven only by that responsibility. It's kind of like, should you be at church when you can? Yes, not because of the law, not because there's some rule, but because you delight in hearing the word and worshiping with others. Let me challenge you to give sacrificially. Be willing at times to go through seasons where you go without something in order to give back to something. What is something you can give up so that you can give at times to needs? And then thirdly, I want to encourage you, if you have children, teach them to give. I think a great model is help them as they receive money to put it in three categories. Save some, spend some, give some. I think you should teach them that. And I think you should show them that. One of the best things my parents ever did when I was in my older teenage years is they taught us how to do their taxes. And so in that, I saw my parents' finances. And I saw what they made. I saw what they paid the government. And I saw what they gave. They didn't just teach me to save some, spend some, and give some. They showed it. That is a powerful way. Spouses, you should have that conversation. We should be driven to be faithful, generous people, both from a practical perspective and a spiritual perspective. I'm thankful of how kind God has been in the life of this church, years and years, patterns of faithful, generous giving. I want to encourage us to not be like the Corinthians, to not fade in that responsibility.